This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition, our focal point is the status and future of strategic arms nuclear treaties and the implications posed by deployment of a small so-called pinpoint nuclear warhead aboard U.S. missile submarines. Over the past decade, Washington and Moscow, by a series of treaties, have reduced both their stockpiles of nuclear warheads and the missiles and aircraft that can deliver them. Through the progression of these treaties, from START 1, an acronym for Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, through START 2, in the present-day New START agreement, warheads have been removed from active service, missiles in their in-ground silos dismantled, and long-range bombers such as the B-52 have been cut up. New START began on February 5, 2011, and it ends on that date in 2021. There is a built-in five-year treaty extension that Moscow says it is open to discuss, but so far, Washington has not signaled the same. This after the United States has exited the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, asserting that Russia has not complied with its terms. What is the future for strategic arms limitation agreements? At this point, the answer is not clear. As for the new small warhead on U.S. submarines, it's rated at roughly half the size of the nuclear weapon that destroyed Hiroshima, Japan, in August 1945. In practical use, it would be directed at specific targets, more tactical than strategic, according to some. Proponents of this new warhead say it provides both deterrence and so-called measured response to an adversary's use of a nuclear weapon, but others disagree. Hello. I'm VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Carol Castiel. With us to define and discuss the situation are two seasoned nuclear arms analysts. From the Washington office of the research organization Council on Foreign Relations, Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow June Kim, and the Director of Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists, Hans Christensen, who has recently published a position paper on the deployment of the small nuclear weapon known as the W-76-2. First, let's discuss where things stand with strategic arms agreements. The one now in force, New START, limits both the United States and Russia to 700 delivery systems, whether they're aircraft or missiles, either land or submarine-based, with another 100 in reserve for a total of 800 delivery systems. And New START limits the total number of deployed nuclear warheads to 1,550 on each side. There are voices in Washington both for retaining and extending this treaty, and there's others that say Russia is engaged in a new arms race and the United States cannot be left behind. Mr. Christensen, describe what both sides in Washington are saying about New START.
Well, one side is saying that continuing the New START treaty is essential for continuing the process of drawing down strategic nuclear forces and keeping a cap on them. Another group is saying that it might have outlived its purpose because we need to broaden the strategic discussion to also include other countries such as China.
All right. Ms. Kim, what can you add to that?
If we don't extend the New START treaty, I think it will give Washington disadvantage because that if the New START treaty is extended, we will buy time until we modernize the current stockpile and nuclear weapon system without the danger of Russia actually increasing their stockpile. And the argument about China not having any constraint under the current treaty is false because China does not have the stockpile that are matchable to the current Russia and United States stockpiles. So including China to the treaty or the argument saying that because China has no constraint, we need to think about China's increase of their stockpiles is not beneficial for the United States standpoint because if China is included in the treaty, we will actually give them the wiggle room to increase their stockpile because the current number is extremely low compared to the Russia and the United States.
Do we have inventory numbers on China at this point? I mean, we know by New START that we have 800 delivery vehicles between the United States and Russia apiece, and we also have 1,550 warheads. What about China? How many delivery vehicles, how many warheads? What do you know?
Strategic delivery vehicles, That means those that can reach across the Pacific.
Right.
That's a number that is about a 90 or so. It's entirely intercontinental ballistic missiles. In terms of warheads, much, much lower than the U.S. Arsenal of nearly 4,000, Russian a little higher. The Chinese is thought to be in the range of about 300.
Are there any other nuclear powers that have both capable delivery vehicles that are beyond theater range?
Yes, Britain and France also have intercontinental ballistic missiles on strategic submarines. So those four countries, the United States, Russia, and Britain and France, are the ones that have those, and now obviously China to a growing extent. We're seeing other countries like India trying to deliver or develop systems that have longer range, and they're not quite at intercontinental range because, of course, India's adversary is pretty close to in terms of Pakistan and China. So still mainly those original P5s, the original five nuclear powers that have those capabilities.
Of course, India is very aggressively working on SLVs and space launch vehicles. And historically, countries that develop a successful SLV often wind up with the same vehicle capable of being an ICBM.
They
so
can
there's
be converted,
a capability.
Yes. They can be converted. And it's also clear that those that developed ICBMs did it partly through space launch programs. And so there's a flow of technology back and forth between those two.
Let's stay on New START for a minute here so that we can continue that discussion. Moscow says it is willing to discuss the built-in five-year extension in New START. But so far, Washington has not signaled whether it agrees to continue under those terms. Now, we've heard the public statements back and forth, but talk about what's going on behind the scenes on both sides. What are the back discussions in both the Kremlin and the Pentagon and, for that matter, the White House? What are these back discussions on New START? Talk about it.
Well, I would say, so in Washington, we've had a conversation over the last year or two. This extension of New START was coming up, and everybody knew about it. And so the way people have been discussing this is basically, should we make an extension of a treaty with Russia when Russia is partly trying to build nuclear weapons with long range that do not fall under the treaty's limits? Are they trying to sort of bypass it? And also, how important is it trying to get China on board? Should we really put more pressure on getting China on board than trying to limit Russia? You know, how do we play these two things? So that's one kind of conversation. And the other conversation that's going on, of course, is seen from Moscow, we have a Trump administration that has been very unclear about where it wants to go with arms control and then not presented any alternatives to not extending New START, except wouldn't it be great to have another treaty? It wouldn't be great to China on board. So Moscow sees that. They see that as an opportunity to play the good guys and say, listen, we're willing. You know, we want to extend this unconditionally. What are you doing? You know, so it's for Russia, it's also a way of improving its profile after the failure of the INF treaty.
And if Washington keeps arguing that we need to consider both Russia and China, we need to also think about what can Washington offer to China if it were to include China into the treaty. Currently, Washington does not have anything to offer for China to have the incentive to join the treaty when, as I mentioned earlier, Russia and the United States have incomparable stockpiles compared to China.
You know, here's another thing about New START and where the treaty lies, where it could go. And that's technologies that are not covered by New START. And, of course, the first thing off the top of my head is hypersonic glide weapons. There's nothing in New START whatsoever about these emerging technologies that are not so much emerging that they're actually being proven at this point. Mr. Christensen, let's talk about technologies flying under the radar of the treaty, or at least under the paper of the treaty. What about this?
Well, the good news about New START is that it covers weapons that are launched by ballistic missiles and long-range bombers beyond a certain range. And so if a hyperglide vehicle is launched by a ballistic missile, like the new Russian Avangard, it is covered by the New START treaty. And the Russians have said it's covered. And our guys believe it is covered. The areas where there is some discussion about it are relating to two other weapon systems. One is a very long-range torpedo or underwater drone, which is clearly not covered by the treaty. And then there's also the issue of a ground-launched nuclear-powered cruise missile. Those two would not be covered by the treaty. But those two are very, very sort of silver bullet, very limited programs. And so if one insists that they have to be covered, or one should, you know, risk the treaty over those two type of weapon system, you have to put those two systems in perspective. What's most important, getting these relatively few weapons included, or controlling the vast majority of the Russian nuclear arsenal?
The nuclear cruise missile, wasn't that a point of contention raised by Washington when it abrogated, when it vacated the INF treaty?
Well, the nuclear-powered cruise missile has a very, very long range that goes even beyond the INF range, so to speak.
Okay.
But so it would fall into another category. What Russia and the United States argued about, of course, was the group of missiles that are between 500 kilometers and 5,500 kilometers.
Right. Which is the INF range.
Correct.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Nuclear Security Fellow Jun Kim at the Washington Office of the Research Organization, Consul on Foreign Relations, and from the Federation of American Scientists, Nuclear Information Project Director Hans Christensen. Today's VOA Encounter program focuses on the current status and future of nuclear arms agreements between the United States and Russia and other nuclear nations, possibly, and also the strategies and implications connected to the deployment of a small nuclear warhead aboard U.S. missile submarines. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/encounter. You can also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or you can connect with Encounter on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to one of our VOA Encounter listeners, Valentin Chibuweze of Enugu, Nigeria. If you want to hear your own name and country on this program, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Or on Facebook, give us a like and leave us a comment. Let's get back to the discussion on nuclear arms treaties and hardware developments. Now let's examine the implication of this new nuclear warhead, the W76-2. It's half the size of the nuclear weapon that flattened Hiroshima, Japan in August 1945. When I learned of this warhead's deployment, I immediately thought of it as tactical rather than strategic. A warhead used to, for instance, destroy a naval base, a missile launching facility, a leadership bunker, or perhaps a nation's nuclear enrichment capabilities. Along with using this small warhead to take out a specific target rather than annihilate a large landmass, there's the theory of measured response. This means that if an adversary used a small nuclear weapon against a U.S. asset, then Washington would have the ability to, as the saying goes, take an eye for an eye with a similar response without escalating to the level of nuclear weaponry that erases a whole major metro area or a similar effect. Let's discuss this theorem of measured response. In the heat of conflict, in the face of possible escalation, would there indeed just be an eye for an eye? Or would the thought of a massive response be entertained to ensure an adversary's total destruction? Ms. Kim, what's your perspective on this?
So personally, I don't think that there's a possibility that United States can escalate just to the degree that it will just use one low-yield weapon. I believe that once United States responds with low-yield weapon, there will be a follow-up, and then eventually it will escalate to a nuclear war. So in the sense that the argument that Russia is escalate to de-escalate and the United States wants to have an option to respond with low-yield weapon, I think there's a danger to it. However, the rationale behind the U.S. government is that Russia is currently modernizing their nuclear weapon system in a way that they will have the option to use low-yield weapon against contingencies in Europe. And currently, the United States does not have option to use low-yield weapon against Russia contingencies because it would either have to use the conventional weapon or use a strategic nuclear weapon. However, it is true that many allies believe that United States will be reluctant and too cautious to use strategic weapon in any serious contingencies. So in order for deterrence to work against Russia, the argument is that United States should have flexible options, such as having low yield option.
I'm going to go back to the good old days of the Cold War. Let's bring up the Fulda Gap. Okay, for our listeners, the Fulda Gap is a part of Germany that's rather hilly, almost mountainous, and this would have been the main mountain pass or the main transit area through which the Russian army would have invaded West Germany. If indeed there would have been a invasion or a provocation, the chances are it would have been at the Fulda Gap. So for the longest time, part of our strategic posture was we had tactical nuclear weapons that were available and deployable so that if we suddenly saw a mass movement of Russian armor going through the Fulda Gap, they could, quote unquote, seal it with a tactical nuclear weapon of moderate yield. I'm not going to come up with a number, but just a moderate yield nuclear weapon, and not only take out the force, but make passage through the area essentially impossible. Now, this is back in the Cold War days when that was a very specifically focused point because it was very strategic for both sides. What do we have today in present terms? Mr. Christensen, what kind of Fulda Gap do we have today?
Well, today the tables have been turned. And so today it is Russia that perceives the United States has an overwhelming conventional capability that they need to use low-yield tactical nuclear weapons to defend against. So we have this flip situation. But there are two issues in this. One is about whether it's needed. The other one is, if it is, what will happen if we start doing it? On the first part, it's a common misunderstanding that the United States does not have low-yield nuclear options in its arsenal today. We have a lot. By my count, we have about 1,000 nuclear warheads in our stockpile that have low-yield options built into them. 115 or 150 or so of those are currently deployed in Europe. They have yields of exactly the same range that the new warhead that has been deployed has. The only difference is that they're delivered by aircraft, not by fast-flying ballistic missiles. So the argument from those who advocate this new weapon system is that, well, we understand that, but we need to have a low-yield option on a fast-flying ballistic missile that can get through missile defenses and air defense systems.
Okay, but now I'm going to bring up the next point, and that is that we have had a standing procedure for decades, and so have the Russians. And it's called launch on warning. So both sides have orbiting detection satellites, and they're focused on each other's territory, and they're circling around the Earth. And if they saw, for instance, if the United States theoretically used one of these new W-76-2s and it's launched from a submarine, you've got a launch detection satellite sitting up there that instantly says, I see a heat signature, okay? Something's in boost phase. Now, these things are smart enough that they can tell the heat signature and pretty well discern what they're looking at, okay? And because of that, they would have a pretty good idea that this is a Trident D5. I'm sure that they know what a Trident D5 signature looks like by now. So they see a single D5 launch. What does the other side think at that point?
You mean the Russian side,
yes,
right? Yeah, Russian side will not be able to distinguish between the low-yield weapon or thermonuclear weapon.
True.
Right.
So if they can't distinguish, but they only see a single one launched, what's the decision swirling around over on the other side in the Kremlin? What are they thinking at this point?
I would say they will go for the worst-case scenario and launch an attack with maximum capability.
Mr. Christensen?
That is definitely the risk, and this is why everybody is really concerned about this development. Do we seriously imagine that once nukes start going off, that either side will back down? Why would we? We wouldn't back down. We have a nuclear strategy that is explicitly developed so that we can scale up our response to make the other side try to back down. So this, I don't believe for a second that this is a de-escalating initiative. On the contrary, I think it buys into the old-fashioned nuclear war fighting scenario.
Then we get into, pardon this, the John Wayne movie. There's a bar full of bad guys, and John Wayne walks into the bar and stares at all the bad guys and pulls out his pistol and shoots one of them. Now, I bring this up not as amusement, but as tactical theory. And this one's called, first we're going to show you something this size. And after it detonates, we're going to give you the information, the message, that there's a lot more where this came from. So you can either knuckle down and put your hands up and do it our way, or you can suffer whatever the consequences are. This is using a W76-2, basically in bully mode. And I don't want to be provocative, but there are other countries besides U.S. and Russia that there are certain concerns about. And I brought up nuclear enrichment facilities specifically because, for instance, and I'm not making a direct connection here because I'm trying to be careful, but Fordo in the Islamic Republic of Iran is dug into the hill of a mountain. And if you wanted to flatten that facility and cancel it out, you're going to need either a deep nuclear earth penetrator, which they do, you know, RNEPs, they do exist, or you do it with something like a W76-2. What about the idea that such a weapon would not necessarily be part of a U.S./Russia/other major power exchange, but something to use toward another country? Am I going off the table here, or is this theoretically possible?
I think it's very possible. I think it's, in fact, intentionally part of the strategy. This is not just about Russia. Of course, we argue for this weapon in that context. It is very much also about how to respond to a country like North Korea, potentially even Iran. So that is part of the strategy. And if you look at where this weapon is now deployed, it started in the Atlantic, and now it is also out in the Pacific.
And where does it go from here? What response on the other side? Every time one side makes a move, the other side makes a move, and then one ratchet forward. So if you were the Russians at this point with the W76-2 deployed, where do you go from here? What's your strategy?
Well, I don't think there's anything in Russian strategy that tells us that their decision to respond to nuclear use has anything to do with how powerful the weapon used against them is. They will respond if it's a nuclear attack, regardless of what the yield is. So I don't think this has anything to do with Russian nuclear strategy. There's more to do with the way we think about this and how we talk to ourselves about it. And mind you, now this is out, and when Russia does not change its strategy or its behavior, well, guess what? Well, then there will be another proposal for another weapon so we can be more credible in our measured response. And that next weapon is going to be a sea-launched nuclear cruise missile.
You know, there's a little bit less than a year left for the U.S.-Russia New START Treaty. Is it still practical and capable of restraining both sides to the agreement? Again, there are strong voices both supporting its continuance and others believing it no longer works or it needs to be left behind to enable new strategic tactics and technologies. More on this will unfold in the coming months. And what about new strategic agreements that would also include other nuclear powers, such as China? There's a lot on the table, and there's good reason to discuss it. The guest analyst on this edition of VOA Encounter, Joon Kim, the Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the research organization Council on Foreign Relations, Washington office. And also from Washington, Hans Christensen, Director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. Sitting in for Encounter's host, Carol Castiel, this is VOA TV Senior Analyst Jeffrey Young. Join us next week for another edition of VOA Encounter.